We're about to have a conversation with Elizabeth Alexander, who, of course, is one of America's great poets, who we all know. Many were introduced to her who did not know her before this in 2009 when she composed and delivered Praise Song for the Day at the inauguration of President Barack Obama. She is now the Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets and the Frederick Iseman Professor of Poetry at Yale University, one of our great writers and thinkers. And her latest book is a memoir called The Light of the World, and which is just an amazingly powerful, beautiful book. And she joins us here on the Mark Steiner Show. And Elizabeth Alexander, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
I kept thinking that the subtitle for this book is Memoir, A Love Story.
Yes, you know, it's precipitated by the story of a terrible, catastrophic loss, the sudden loss of my beloved husband. But what I realized pretty soon into the writing of the book is that what I was writing about was love, which is what made grief meaningful, and that if I wanted my readers to care even more, I had to show them that love and show them that extraordinary person.
Clearly you did that in this book, but the book is, to me, really is a love story. I mean, if I could see you and feel you writing this book to your husband, to Fikre Ghebreyesus, excuse me, even if he was alive. I'm just, you know what I'm saying? It felt like he lived through these pages and your love lived through these pages. And to me, that's what kept going over and over again, except the parts that made me cry when you, at different points in the book. But I mean, it was just a story of this two people who just fell uncontrollably in love and a life that they built.
Well, I like that thought that many of the same things could have been written were he still living. It was a great love story, and I think that the way that I always think about love, and certainly in retrospect, is that it was powerful unto itself, and there is that miracle that happens when two people just collide, combust, and decide to make a family together, which we did in a week, crazy as it seemed. But also that love is meaningful if it radiates outward. And so that's what I tried to talk about as well, out to our children, to our extended family. And because he was a painter and I'm a poet, to the art and goodness that we tried to send out from the core of what we had together.
I was going to go back to the beginning here in a moment, but I was just thinking as you were describing some of the things, and I've seen some of the other interviews you've had, and I've read the book, finished it again last night, just to feel it again. And I just wonder for you, writing this book about this man who you loved, who died all of a sudden and left you, and if your process of not just writing the book, but of talking about it all the time to people like me.
Yeah, you know, that has been, so I'm on the road with the book now, uh-huh. And it has been very intense, very powerful. People come to this book with story of their own. People come to this book having really been moved very deeply and wanting to talk about it. People say things to me like, you know, this gives me a way to think about and talk about grief, which we don't do so easily as a culture. Young people have said, this is the kind of love I want to find in my life. This makes me believe that I can find that love, which sometimes seems so elusive. People have told me that it's made them cherish the day-to-day beauties in their own intimate lives. And so I think that as intense as, and of course there's loss. You know, I've lost a partner, I've lost a child, I've lost so many people have come with that. And so I feel that it's a privilege to be able to engage with those conversations, which are so human and so at the bone of what it means to connect in this lifetime.
Let's take it back. I want people to understand who he was and how you met. How you met Fikre after that speech, the talk you gave, and you were in his restaurant, if I remember correctly, from the beginning of the book.
Yes, Fikre, so he came from Eritrea in East Africa, and like so many other families during that long, long war with Ethiopia, they left as refugees. And he ended up in, first Sudan, Italy, Germany, the United States, and then New Haven, Connecticut, where he sort of landed and stayed once he realized that he could. And he and his brothers ran a beautiful restaurant called Café Adulis. He was the chef. I was living in Chicago, went to New Haven to write a play. He and his brothers gave me an opening night party. There he was. We didn't speak. And then a few days later, in another of their cafes, I was meeting a friend. The friend didn't come. I looked up. There he was, and that was that.
And that was that which got me. You both instantly fell in love. It wasn't like courting for weeks and weeks and, I'll call you tomorrow morning. But no, boom.
That was it. And I think that if there's a message in there about, carpe diem, I was getting ready to go back to Chicago, and I wrote down my Chicago address and phone number. And this was before anyone had email or cell phones or anything like that. And then I also, something said, write down where you'll be for just the next couple of days. And when I got back from doing my errands, the phone was ringing. And he said, come for coffee. I went for coffee. I didn't leave. So I think that, we both must have been ready to make a family, to come together, to take that leap. Certainly we were. But I think that the important thing was, but then we decided to do it. We didn't hesitate. We trusted it. That was the crazy part. But I think that's what people do every day, is decide that they're going to trust this crazy feeling and move forward, and then move forward and build something. Because once you've made that commitment, it's the building.
Right. And, and all couples have their issues and moments, because that's just the nature of two people being in love and being together, mm-hmm. and committing time. But the romance that you describe here, what popped in my head was when you wrote about you had this first house together, and you were pregnant with your first child, and then he comes in and takes you down the street to show you this place that became your other home.
Yes.
That was just to spring that on you and bring you in this place when you're about to also give birth.
Yeah, and it was, I believe, he was coming back from the restaurant, so it was late. 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
It was raining. But, that was how it was with him. He was a person of great ideas and excitement and invention. And we were not young, so I was used to running and controlling my own life. And it was very important and wonderful to say, I trust you, and he turned that into a beautiful saying. He said, I find the nest and you feather the nest.
Hmm.
So, what can you do when somebody says that? You just go out in the rain and you go see your magical new home.
What? One of the things that struck me when you just described that, and also hit me as I was thinking about the book at the end, is that in some ways your marriage was very traditional and very non-traditional.
Interesting.
Even what you just said about feathering the nest,
mm-hmm.
But at the same time you both were like complete equals, and you both cooked and you both raised the children equally, but it was this combination of this new life and the old traditional life from both your traditions, the Black tradition of America that you came from and his Eritrean tradition.
Well, I love that observation, because I think it's really true. I think that certainly it was a true partnership between equals. We respected each other's work powerfully, and we had the ultimate champions in each other. Nobody ever encouraged me to the extent that he did. Even the last thing he said to me was, I'll pick up the children from the orthodontist. You go hear the poetry reading. Mm-hmm. You're an artist. Never forget that. And that was the last conversation that we had. And similarly, my support of his work as a painter, a brilliant, brilliant painter, 882 paintings left behind. And I did everything I could to support that genius and that vision, because, again, we each knew that we had something to share with the world. At the same time, I think that, and I talk about sort of boy-girl courtliness, and I'm a feminist, raised in a feminist generation.
Right.
There was something very beautiful about being able to play like that, and enjoy that aspect of things, because it came from a basis of such fundamental equality.
And I was thinking about, look, a bunch of things popped in my head as you were just speaking about that. One of them was kind of going back to that moment when you said his last words to you, he was going to pick up the kids and take them to the orthodontist, and then your son finding him in the basement.
Yes.
And then you going down to the basement and the whole story of the nurse who you saw on the street who came in and to talk to the paramedics. It was just that was just such a, I mean, that was one of the hardest parts of the book to read for me.
Yeah, I felt that it was that was something that I needed to tell plainly and tell completely and tell honestly and tell up front. That even in that moment when it was happening, I wasn't thinking I'm going to write a book about this, but I did think, pay the closest attention you can because something enormous is happening, and you're going to need to know what happened to you. You're going to need to know what happened to your family. And so it's not like a detached writer brain took over, but you know, the sharpness of observation when you know you're in a moment that's changing your life completely and your children's life, everything was very, 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 very heightened. And so I brought that back to the telling of it because I thought we had to look at it directly in the book.
One of the things that came through this book as well for me is that the two of you were deeply spiritual people, but again, not in a traditional sense.
Yeah. A lot of the book is about figuring out what is spirituality, what is the ritual and the practice that sustains us through crisis when we don't necessarily come straight out of one religious tradition. Figre's people were Coptic, Christian, Orthodox from Eritrea. We were married in the Greek Orthodox Church in Orange, Connecticut, because that was as close as we could get to that. I was raised Episcopalian, but my setting foot in church was usually when I danced with a dance company that where the classes were at St. Mark's Dance Company. You know, there were a lot of practices. There's a part in the book where I say, like, well, you know, I want to be Jewish now. I want to have rules. You know, I want the neighbors to come and walk us around the block when we are done sitting Shiva. I mean, I think that that being artists and intellectuals and questers meant that we were always looking for the different ways that people mark passage, the way that people survive, the things that people do for each other to make community. But, you know, the reality is that our communities are sometimes very hybrid in the United States, and he and I both think that's a fantastic thing.
Right.
You know, my parents are New Yorkers. I mean, you know, you can't grow up in New York City in a silo. I mean, you know, it's it is a fundamentally hybrid way of understanding the world, even if you come out of your own culture and tradition. And so what I realized are some of the things that sustain me, if there was not a church to go to, were extended and chosen family, the village. I keep coming back to that notion of, you know, who are the people who step up and step in? Who are the people who we're moving through this life with? I mean, you know, I have girlfriends who are aunties to my children who are really part of my whole parenting network, who I knew before I met Figre, you know, who feel about my children that they would step in front of a bus for my children.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is that village, and there is also the spiritual and sustaining power of art. And for Figre and for me, it was both making art, because writing this book was a way of stepping forward, and also living with poems and music and images that freeze what is beautiful and terrifying in life and give us a taste of its meaning.
I mean, and the way you describe this man, Figre Ghebreyesus, and you talk about his photo. I looked for his photos when you wrote it. He didn't smile for his pictures. You talked about how beautiful his smile was. He didn't smile for his pictures, which I didn't find any pictures of him smiling. So Obviously, that's,
I'll send you one. But he was very formal about photographs.
Yeah.
In an old world sense, you know, that photographs are taken on occasion in a studio and that you're not corny about it.
And he, I mean, and I was also going through all these photos of his paintings last night and just looking at them. He was, you have this great piece in here about, in the book where you talk about him, and I'll just read this one piece you wrote. You said, Ficre did not paint what he saw in his mind and then painted. And then he found the flowers that were what he painted. He painted what he wanted to continue to see. He painted how he wanted the world to look.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, that it moves me to hear that because that was the miracle of living with him. But the thing that I think is so amazing is that not only do I get to live with some of those paintings and look out at the world through his eyes and see a quite wonderful vision, but that this is work, and I'm so glad you looked at it, that can be shared.
Oh, it's amazing work.
And shared widely, and that's what I want to happen.
I'm talking with poet and writer Elizabeth Alexander about her memoir, The Light of the World. We have to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we'll hear the rest of my conversation with Elizabeth Alexander. And on the way to break, we're hearing Everyday People by Arrested Development. Baba O.J. of Arrested Development was born this day in 1932. Just for one day. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And you're listening to us right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Heroes by David Bowie. Producer Brian Eno was born this day in 1948. And I'm speaking with poet and writer Elizabeth Alexander about her memoir, The Light of the World. She's Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets and the Frederick Eisman Professor of Poetry at Yale University. It's very, very, very beautiful work. I mean, I thought about when you wrote about how he would stand in that mound in your backyard and smoke his cigarette and survey the world around, and the moment that you knew that he was saying goodbye to you.
Yeah.
That's what I mean by this kind of non-traditional spirituality that you seem to, that threads its way all through this book.
Yes, and in understanding, you know, things that, again, I didn't know. You know, it sometimes you don't know what you're up to until you're tested. I mean, that's a cliche, but it's really a true one. When his mother, to whom he was very close, who was a very remarkable woman, very brilliant, very wise, very kind, and very powerful, she imagined shepherding a family through the vagaries of war over decades. You know, figuring out what to do when Ficre went, the reason he left the country is he went to join the front lines, and she went and took him back. They had already lost one son. This is not going to happen, she said, even though their pride in their country was utter and profound. So this was a woman, you know, who was not messing around in any way, shape, or form. And when she was dying, I was very amazed to discover that I could be present in those dying months with her, that I could be helpful, that I wasn't afraid, as I always imagined I would be when facing something so enormous. Now, some of that was, you know, I was her child, but not her child by birth, so I had to be strong, because it was my husband who was losing his mother and his siblings. But I think some of it is the gift of travail when you discover what you are able to do and what you are able to face and how that moves you forward as a stronger and more knowing person. And so to have been through this when dealing with my loss of Ficre and shepherding my children through that, I don't mean to say that it was made easier in any way, but I think I did know a little bit more what I was made out of.
and you feel it all the way through the book, and you feel it growing through the book. And I, when you just talked about your mother-in-law's passing, and you have this wonderful piece in the book about how the coffee is made in Eritrean families and doing that and doing the coffee ceremony. And then you wrote this piece in the paragraph, if you don't mind me reading it to you, and to our listeners. My mother-in-law's last night on earth, a fox crossed her path in Branford, Connecticut, as we left the hospice. We knew somehow that it was her, as I know the ravenous hawk came to take Fikre. Do I believe that? Yes, I do. Poetic logic is my logic. I do not believe she was a fox, but I believe the fox was a harbinger. I believe that it was strange enough occurrence that it should be heeded. Zemesh Berhe, the quick red fox, soon passed from his life to the next. To me, that was such a beautiful little piece because, again, that speaks to things that many of us think but we're afraid to hold on to, that whether it was the totems you talked about, other things as well, that those symbols in our lives, they actually mean something.
I think so. And that was something that in my union with Fikre, my own sense of that was really, really heightened, that the universe is a place full of signs and symbols to be read, and that, you know, not to say that everything is foretold, not to say that everything is made symbolic, but on the other hand, to pay attention, you know, to pay attention. And I think of that in some ways as being a very African writ large way of looking at the world, or perhaps not a mainstream American way of looking at the world, you know, but many, many cultures read the signs and make things symbolic because it helps us understand. And I guess also, you know, this goes to meeting someone and just deciding that you're going to run away and join the circus with them. you know, being open to the surprising occurrences that are around us all the time.
So there's so many places I want to go with this conversation with you because the book really, not every book affects me as profoundly as this one did. I have to tell you.
I can hear it, and I'm really touched by that.
I kept telling my wife last night, "You've got to finish this book. You've got to read this book. You just need to read it." And I was thinking about this word that he had, syncretic. Did I say that right?
Syncretic, yes.
Syncretic, right? Mm-hmm. About how you looked at him as really a man of the African diaspora, even though he was African-born, and how the cultures, your belief in this all-encompassing black culture, and how it's something that came to the two of you together in many ways, that you brought together. Something.
Yes. I mean, of course, you know, Africa is a huge continent with however many different languages spoken and cultural traditions and, you know, hugely, hugely diverse continent. And yet, in diaspora, mostly from West Africa, when you look at, you know, cultural practices in the Caribbean, in Brazil, and, of course, in the United States, you see continuities. You know, I'm a professor of African American studies, and that's one of the things that we think about. In the case of Fikre, coming from East Africa, coming from a different tradition, coming to this country, of course, as from a people who had never been enslaved, coming as a refugee but coming voluntarily, but, you know, the complexities of all of that, and coming as someone who, as an intellectual and an artistic child, knew about black power rhetorics from all over the world, knew about James Brown, you know, knew about Fela Kuti, knew about Bob Marley, knew about Angela Davis, and you know, that was one of his icons. He wanted to marry someone with an Angela Davis afro. I was like, well, I can't help you there, but, you know, that's a good thing to wish for. And so, you know, and I, too, in thinking from Washington, D.C., where I grew up, a very, very international black city, thinking, how do I connect to all of this? You know, really trying to figure that out. How do I connect? Because, of course, there are limitations to those connections. You don't want to overstate it. You want to have respect for the particularities of culture. And yet, there is an adherence. And we both found that topic quite infinitely fascinating in our talk and in our practice and in our philosophy. What does it mean to bring together the best of everything and think about how it holds?
Yeah, and exactly. And I think that there's so much of this you bring us in this book, from the little piece about the symmetry, how you measured all yourselves before he died, mm-hmm. all the same size.
Yeah.
All the same height. Was it 5'9"? Is that right?
5'9", right. Just a smidge, yep.
And those kind of things that kind of – because I think they – what I know you were healing yourself in writing this book.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because I didn't set out to do it that way, and I think about the craft of writing as being separate from the work of grieving. So I think more that, like, there was the work of writing the book and the work of grieving, and those two things went along parallel tracks that sometimes overlapped. But now that all is said and done, now that the book is out there, and now that the book is moving me forward on a journey that, is so interesting and that I don't know where it's taking me, I can more easily see it as part of a process.
You quote a couple times in the book and ponder a poem written by a woman who I knew very well before she passed away, Lucille Clifton.
Oh, yes, because you're a Maryland person.
And
yes.
we were neighbors for 18 years in Windsor Hills.
Oh, my goodness. Right. Lucky you.
Yes, lucky me. Exactly. And we did a couple of programs about Lucille after she passed away. And one of the things, some of the pieces you pulled out was like a voice from the undead past, the light that came to Lucille Clifton. And you,
yeah.
As you're pondering your own through her poem.
Well, I mean, Lucille, people ask me, there are these grief memoirs, Year of Magical Thinking and so forth. Did you read those, in order to write this book? The answer to that is I had read those. I'm interested in those, but I read them before they had anything to do with my life. And then I didn't reread them when I was writing because I didn't want anything to interfere. But what did I continue to read? I read Lucille Clifton because I think that her philosophizing, her wisdom, her probing spiritual intellect, her understanding that you can talk to people who have passed away. I mean, in her poems, her husband, Fred, who dies at 49,
yes.
Speaks to her from the other side, tells her what dying is like, and that is done without a hitch. I found that not only comforting, but also it just felt so true to me. Her work felt truer and deeper than ever. And in that poem, The Light That Came to Lucille Clifton, one of my sort of mantra poems of life, "You might as well open the door, my child, the truth is furiously knocking," felt like Lucille herself telling me to move forward in my life and to move forward with this book, and that we don't know what is ahead of us, but we have to keep walking life's path. As she did with so much courage, throughout, many, many woes, illnesses, so many things that she battled. But she was a survivor, and I like to think of myself as a survivor as well.
More than that, I think. And more than that. At least I feel it from the book. I was wondering how you and how your children, how the boys are doing now.
Thanks for asking. The boys are now in 10th and 11th grades.
I thought so. Right.
Yeah, and they are amazing. They carry their father with them in the most beautiful way. We talk about him all the time, which sometimes brings us to tears and sometimes brings us to laughter and sometimes brings us to meditation. But the one thing I was clear about is I didn't want to speak in hushed tones about him. I didn't want them ever to feel that they shouldn't get upset or would upset me or, that there was anything not to be said. I wanted him to be the ongoing presence that he is, and I believe that that is very strengthening to my children, even though, of course, they miss him so. so very much.
I can't imagine, but being the kind of a writer and a poet, a little bit of myself, I can't imagine. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, I can feel them and feel that just looking at my own kids and thinking what they might go through. And I think about, you wrote about how Fikre believed in putting hands on children. And I don't mean corporal punishment. I mean hands, feeling, touching, just like he did with people he cared about, and how you leave this imprint with your hands.
That's right. And he really did. And he was very fervent about the need for, you know, it's interesting, actually, on the, I mean, he didn't swat our children, but one of the things that he said on that topic and that sort of American debate was he was less focused on do people spank their children and more focused on people need to have their hands on their children all the time.
Right.
You know, and that what, you know, that a swat in the context of, and, you know, I'm not trying to open up a whole can of worms on your radio show, but in the context of constantly putting your hands on your children, it has a very different meaning from that's the only time you touch your children. And, you know, he just communicated everything through that touch. I mean, his last morning on earth, he was in his 13-year-old son's bed. You know, he declares, this is the most comfortable bed I have ever slept in.
A sleepover with his son.
Yes, a sleepover with his son. A sleepover with his son. And, you know, I think that's a very beautiful thing.
You gave it to me. This is a story full of music and art and food. And when you write about how you the last music you two listened to together, I think is what you wrote, was Yosef Atif's The Plum Blossom.
Yes.
Right?
Gorgeous piece of music.
Oh, my God.
A music that was given to him by a dear friend on Fikre's 50th birthday, which we celebrated 4 days before he passed. And, you know, the music, we were great avid lovers of music, and that was one of, I mean, I write as well about coming together and sort of the soundtrack of falling in love, you know, Randy Weston and Don Pullen and Betty Carter and Ahmad Jamal and Bob Marley and Ali Farka Touré and, you know, that great music that so stirs and fills you, the things that music does to you that nothing else can do, the feeling that music takes you to, and the way that music can take you to feeling without your even having to work. I mean, I think I found that in the months after he died, I couldn't read. First time in my life, you know, I'm always reading 500 books at once, and I couldn't read for months and months and months. I think it was too much feeling, too much effort, too much. But I could and did listen to music because it would just wash over me, and it would take me places without my having to do anything. And usually that place was tears and sorrow, but that was a kind of necessary catharsis. And the ways also that, you know, we would put on music as I do now, as I do pretty much every day of my life, and dance, what a power is that. I felt like the book would not be true to us if it didn't have all of that music threaded through it.
And the recipes, I have to try some of them.
You must. People are telling me from all over that they're trying these recipes, which is really quite a trip. And it's wonderful to think that all these people are making Fikre's dishes.
No, I know. It's great. I mean, I'm really glad you put those in there because I am the cook in my house primarily.
Well,
so
let me know. There's a lot of yummy.
They sound delicious. So finally, I was wondering, does he still come back in your dreams?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's, of course, a lot of stuff about dreams in the book.
Lots.
And my dreams, my son Simon's dreams. I believe in dream visitations. He has not been in my dreams for some time now. And I think that when that happens, in a way, I don't know, it's almost like the subconscious protecting itself, or maybe it's Fikre protecting me from a kind of depth of feeling that, you know, I'll have when I'm ready to. And because right now what I have to do is take this book out and keep it together. So that's all I can think about for why he's not there now. But I know that that won't be true forever.
Well, I think you've given us in this book something that as I said, it's more than a memoir. I mean, it's a story about a deep love and how two people can build a life together and remembering somebody who meant so much and contributed so much to our world and to you. And I could go on and talk with you here about this book for the next 2 hours, but I.
Well, this is such a beautiful conversation, Mark. I so appreciate your depth of feeling for the book. It means a lot to me, and I think that we just cherish what we have every day, because as extraordinary as he was and is, I think that, you know, as I say in the book, you know, the people that we will come to love have already been born before we start longing for them, and it's always a miracle that people come together, and it happens every single day. And so I think that we can cherish what we have in the everyday and honor that love and let it radiate out.
Well, I want to thank you for your philosophy of existence and what you bring to us all and what this book brings to us all, The Light of the World, a memoir. Elizabeth Alexander, it's been a real honor and a treat to talk to you, and I would hope that this won't be the last time.
Well, I'm sure it won't be. Thank you so very much, Mark.
Thank you.